I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me because you didn't use LinkedIn jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. quince.com/style.
This is Little Atoms, a radio show about ideas and culture. With me, Neil Denny. This week, Atessa Moshfegh returns to the show to talk about her latest novel, My Year of Rest and Relaxation. Atessa Moshfegh is a fiction writer from Boston. She was awarded the Plimpton Prize for her stories in the Paris Review and granted a creative writing fellowship from the National Endowment for the Arts. Her first book, the novella Magloo, was recently published by Vintage, and you may recall us talking about that novella, as well as her short story collection, Homesick for Another World, on a previous Little Atoms. Her novel Eileen was awarded the 2016 Penn Hemingway Award and was shortlisted for the Man Booker Prize. Tessa's latest novel is My Year of Rest and Relaxation, which we're going to talk about today. Tessa, welcome back to Little Atoms.
Good to be back.
How would you describe this book?
It's a novel.
It is.
It's about a woman in her mid-20s, living in Manhattan, on the Upper East Side of Manhattan. And the year is 2000. It's the turn of the millennium. She comes from a rather privileged background. She is recently orphaned, has a pretty meaningless job at a pretty pretentious art gallery in Chelsea, and is altogether pretty dissatisfied and disappointed by reality as she sees it. She makes this decision to go into what she calls hibernation for a year, with the thought that if she could only sleep for long enough, her body, her mind, and every cell that she's composed of would have enough time to regenerate to the point that it would have forgotten all of the past difficulties, pain, and trauma that had stored, and that she would eventually wake up a new person, rejuvenated, renewed, with a different perspective, and even maybe the world would seem different to her too, that reality itself may have shifted.
And that renewal is important because this is, you know, she takes this regime of medication, and this would be quite easy to think of as a book about someone that's suicidal, but then that's not really the point, is it? It is about rebirth.
Yeah.
In terms of talking about the time period that it's set, as you said, it's set in 2000. So where did the idea for the book come from?
Well, the idea for the book came from a desire to write a novel in a similar tradition as my short stories. I wanted to write a novel that was a development of the style of writing that I had developed in the collection. And this character is not unlike, I mean, in the first few scenes that we see her, is not unlike a character from one of my stories. It's just that the character sort of gave birth to this premise, which required a novel to write. I did set out to write the novel. I didn't totally know what I was getting into when I began, and it was very difficult, actually, to resolve. I did not realize that I was setting myself up with quite a challenge, which is, how do you write a novel about someone who sleeps? The answer is, you have to wake them up occasionally.
Yeah. And why the time period then? Why 2000?
It was setting, you know, in retrospect, I can come up with lots of reasons, but at the time, it was more of a realization than a decision to set the book in the year 2000. And a lot of the book was sort of dictated through the narrative to me by the character. and her judgments and assessments of the art world in that period and the way that she was describing New York City, I identified as not being contemporary Manhattan at all, but being a pre-9/11 New York. The culture was different. There was still a sense of grit and glamour that had this sort of synergy. There was a sense of okayness in some of the people. There was, I don't want to call it the calm before the storm because it wasn't exactly calm per se. It was like there was a sense of here we are, this is the way that things are, and we're so certain of it that there's even room for absurdity.
This was also the end of history, right? Yeah, I mean, boy, is that guy's face red now.
Yeah, it was the end of a millennium, and also the beginning of a new one. There was a lot of people were in a good financial position, including this protagonist. Riding the wave of the financial boom of the 90s, the country did feel different than what happened subsequently. Yeah.
And as you mentioned, it's fundamentally a story about privilege. She's obviously financially secure enough to be able to do this thing, which is this project, which is to just decide to go to sleep for a year. Mm-hmm. All her financial worries will be taken care of. And obviously privilege is a conversation of now. You know, this book seem very current because this is clearly a sort of hot political thing at the moment, the idea of privilege.
Well, it's interesting what gets projected onto a project, you know, because at the time I didn't think, oh, I would like to write a book about privilege. At the time, I was like, well, I have this premise. Now, how would it be possible that someone could take a year off and sleep? Well, she better have some independent wealth. You know, I came at it from the other side rather than, oh, I want to write a book about privilege. What's the most privileged thing you could do? It was really, here's somebody with an existential and emotional problem. If she tries to solve it this way, I'm going to have to account for it. So, therefore, she needs to have money.
She's also, I mean, she's a really compelling character, but, I mean, he's fundamentally unsympathetic. And that's something you do throughout your writing. You write these brilliant but troubled, difficult characters. And you're not on Twitter yourself, but, you know, I seem to see more often than not nowadays, people seem to really struggle with the very concept that you can have an unsympathetic character. Have you come across that?
Yeah. I also think the whole thing about her being unlikable is just a conversation that's being had. I don't know, like, individuals don't come up to me and say, oh, she's so unlikable. I mean, if you don't like her, that's fine. But I think it's more of a popular conversation topic than it is, I think, a real experience of the book. I mean, I don't really know. Honestly, this whole, like, likability thing, like, I don't like likable characters. They're boring. There's nothing to like about them. They're just blank, goody-two-shoes people. What's interesting about that? I mean, this woman has opinions. She's complicated. She contradicts herself sometimes. She seems to me to be both more human and thus more relatable than somebody who's like some, I don't know, very well-polished, civilized whatever. And I don't understand why people want to dislike her so much. I mean, is it just that, like, we're trained to dislike people with privilege because that's what's politically correct right now? Or is it that they just feel judged by her? Don't take it so personally. Is it,
Well, she's certainly judging other people in the book. So we'll get to her relationship with her supposed best friend, Raver, a bit mm-hmm. later on. But, the way that she describes her supposed best friend throughout the book is unlikable.
Well, Reva is unlikable, but so is everybody else. I mean, I don't know. This is the thing. Like, we can point out, like, yeah, she's critical, but, like, what else are you supposed to say about somebody? The whole point is that it's a first-person point of view with somebody who's deciding to opt out of life. So, of course, she's going to have criticisms of all the things that come and interrupt her.
You mentioned the short story collection and how this story has somehow come out of a sort of extension of that collection. But I was also struck by McGlue, which is a completely different story and different time period, but it's a first-person narration by somebody who is basically throughout the book under the influence of alcohol. And this is a story about someone who's under the influence of various different drugs. And I wanted to talk about how you do that, how you create these characters and how you have them describe their situation and what's going on while under the influence.
I just tried to enter their realm. I concentrate and meditate on who they are and where they are and what the situation is, and listen to whatever thoughts might be running through their mind into mine, and then editorialize it and manipulate it so that I can get the story told through the voice that I hear.
And this brings us nicely to the psychiatrist, Dr. Mm-hmm. Tuttle, who's another fantastic and monstrous creation. Mm-hmm. Where does she come from?
She sort of just appeared to me fully formed as a figure. I never really saw her as a monster. I saw her as, like, pretty benign, actually, in her mannerisms. Actually sort of a gentle person. The gentle person managing great poisons. And I thought she was really funny. She was quirky in a way that was unpredictable, but also made total sense to me. And like a wonderful comic relief.
Mm-hmm.
And she also added an important element to the book that I thought was sort of the solution to its own self-seriousness, which was an element of the fantastic. I mean, this isn't a book that's pretending to be nonfiction. I mean, this is a... There's an element of, I won't say it's like surreal, but you do have to suspend your disbelief in order to, you know, ingest the book.
And she is. She's really funny. And in fact, this book is. I mean, we might sound like we're talking about a book that's a quite grim subject matter, but it's really funny. Mm. It is really funny. And I heard, I'm not sure what it was. It was another podcast, but David Sedaris mentioned your book and how much he likes your work. And described your writing as funny in a way that the person that's writing it doesn't necessarily know that they're funny. What do you think that means? Does that sound right to you?
I think he doesn't know me very well. But, he's been a huge supporter of my work, and I'm really grateful and flattered that he likes it. And I think that he thinks that I might not know I'm being funny is actually a huge compliment, because it means I'm getting away with it without being transparent. So, yes, I know I'm being funny. I'm just really good at it. Ha 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 ha.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
With LinkedIn Jobs, we tap into a network of more than a billion professionals to help you find quality professionals quickly and easily for any role you need. Marketing wizards? Found them.
Software engineers?
Found.
That project manager I could never seem to hire?
And found. LinkedIn Jobs quickly matches your roles with candidates with the right skills and experience. In fact, 86% of small businesses get a qualified candidate within 24 hours. Post your first job for free and get started at linkedin.com/spoken. That's linkedin.com/spoken. Terms and conditions apply.
Imagine the softest sheets you've ever felt. Now imagine them getting even softer over time.
That's what you'll feel with Boll & Branch's organic cotton sheets. In a recent customer survey, 96% replied that Boll & Branch sheets get softer with every wash. So start getting your best night's sleep in sheets that get softer and softer for years to come. And you can try their sheets with a 30-night guarantee, plus 15% off your first order with code BUTTERY. So head to bollandbranch.com today. Exclusions apply. See site for details.
You're listening to Little Atoms. I'm Neo Denny. Today I'm talking to Ottessa Moshfegh. We're talking about her latest novel, My Year of Rest and Relaxation. Ottessa, we mentioned Dr. Tuttle, and she's the psychiatrist that prescribes this regime of various different medications to our narrator, some of which are invented, which we'll get to in a minute, but plenty of them aren't. And she does take fistfuls of various different, you know, antidepressants or, you know, sleep medications and things. How much sort of research did you do into these sort of medications and whether or not these great fistfuls of drugs would actually do what they're supposed to do?
Well, I tried every single drug in the book, and I built up a tolerance to most of them, to the point where I could take this amount of medication and continue to write, which is a total joke. Of course, I didn't do that. There's no way I could have researched all this stuff. I mean, it's not meant to be taken literally either. I think there's probably enough out there that the average reader has associations with things like Ambien or, Ambien is probably the most popular sleep aid, prescription sleep aid. I don't know. Do you call it Ambien here?
Well, I certainly know the name. Whether or not it's the same, you would get that prescribed here. I don't know, but...
I don't know. But, you know, I figured it doesn't really matter how much the reader knows or how much this is accurate, because it's, like I said, it's not to be taken so literally. The book kind of prescribes the terms for itself, and then you read it and you don't worry. I mean, I don't know how worried people are, like, oh, is she going to be okay? Like, of course she's okay. She's narrating the book from retrospect. We know that she survives, and that's all you really need to worry about.
Well, indeed. So the main made-up drug, Infermiterol,
yep.
Would you say? It's this a drug that basically puts her into like a fugue state for days. She has these blackouts where she'll wake up and the flat is full of like new shopping and stuff that she's been out and purchased in the 3 days when she's been under and has no idea that she's done it. Where does this idea come from?
Well, I think the idea, I mean... The blackout isn't a new idea. I mean, I needed not to expose too much of the inner workings of the book, but something had to happen. I mean, a book about somebody sleeping successfully for a year would be very boring, so there needed to be some kind of self-interruption. And this new drug, Infermiterol, creates essentially an alter ego for our character, and that alter ego seems to have an agenda. And therein lies the conflict that the protagonist needs to resolve. So that's really the purpose of the Infermiterol. And I think it doubly serves a purpose that she doesn't have to be conscious during any of these activities, which seem to indicate that she wants something more for herself than she can admit in her conscious life.
And indeed, you could have, bearing that in mind, you could have written those scenes where she goes out under the influence to all of these parties and to the shops and things. But all we get is just the fragments of what might have happened in those days when she returns.
Right, we get the evidence of that, right.
I mentioned Reva, her best friend, and again, a best friend in inverted commas, because for both of them, really, one would never believe they were best friends. They sort of cling to each other in the absence of anybody else. Why does she maintain this relationship? Why do they maintain this relationship?
I think they need each other, and I think they're very codependent in their need for each other. If you read the book, you'll see there's a very delicate balance between them. Reva looks up to the protagonist in a way that also puts her in a position of judging her, and in doing so empowers Reva. And the same can be said for the protagonist. There's a system of judgment, condemnation, and superiority through comparison in different areas of personhood. And it's that sort of thing, like, you hate, when we hate someone, It might be because they're expressing something that we can't stand to look at in ourselves. And I think that they are kind of reverse images of one another, although they do have plenty in common, too. And I think they have they enjoy the disgust that each other elicits in their, you know, repartee.
Tell us more about Reva. Who is she?
Reva's a college friend, and she also lives in Manhattan. She lives on the other side of town. She comes from a more middle-class background. She's Jewish. She works as a secretary, first in a midtown insurance brokerage firm, and then gets transferred to a different position in the same company who has offices in the World Trade Center. She's pretty superficial, sort of the kind of person to be obsessed with brand names and knockoff designer handbags. And she's also like pretty keen on like self-help and, you know, whatever's popular, but she doesn't seem to have very many intimate friends. And I think she's probably incapable of real intimacy, just like our protagonist is. And I think that their friendship remains in a loving yet sterile zone where they both feel safe. So, yeah, Reva doesn't like for things to get messy, and neither does the narrator.
And I also want to talk about Trevor, who's our narrator's sort of on-off lover, in the past, from the position where she's narrating. Who is he?
Trevor is, yes, just as you said, an on-again, off-again quasi-boyfriend who works on Wall Street and is sort of a flat character. We don't get to know him very well. We know that he likes to make money, that he's kind of cocky, and that he returns to our protagonist at her request with some sort of sadistic thrill. And she's game. So he's just a recurring character that I think reflects her really sort of self-destructive need. Like, Trevor confirms the protagonist's cynicism about love and human connection, in that she calls and requests his company when she most desperately needs to be comforted, and he provides her with company but absolutely no comfort, and in so doing confirms her cynicism that there really is nothing that we can offer each other, that everybody is sort of his or her own satellite, and that feelings do not transgress.
And you mentioned earlier when talking about the idea of privilege that obviously when you're sitting down to write this book, you know, you're not necessarily addressing concerns of the day. But, you know, now we're in this sort of like Me Too world. Trevor, you know, works on Wall Street. He seems like a bit of an asshole. But our narrator also talks about other men that she's encountered at college, men that we might think should be better, you know, progressive men, left-wing men, sensitive men that read books, and how basically, you know, those guys are just as likely to be assholes.
I mean, she's an asshole too.
Well, that is true.
I can't even engage with that Me Too stuff. It's so, I didn't write this book as a response to Me Too. I wrote this book like 2.5 years ago or 3 years ago. It takes place in the year 2000. Men and women in their early 20s are idiots, and they don't know how to have respect for each other or themselves, oftentimes when it comes to sex, because it's new to them, and we've all been poisoned by a totally pornographic culture that thinks that, you know, up until like 6 months ago, every movie, TV show, etc., was like, it's cool to be a womanizing asshole. Like, that means you're like big, strong man. And, you know, up until like 6 months ago, it was cool to be a little coquette slut because that meant you had power in your sexuality as a woman. Well, okay, so the rules have changed. It doesn't mean that the past has changed or that we need to somehow like hold everybody accountable for things in literature that are occurring 18 years ago. So I don't really see how this book fits into that conversation, but of course people can talk about whatever they want.
And you've already mentioned that a narrator works for a while in a Chelsea art gallery.
Right.
As a sort of like, you know, receptionist stroke ornament in the gallery. And this allows you to have, like, you know, some fun with the art world of the end of the last century. And you mentioned that looking back, that old world might have changed. So how do you think it's changed?
You know, I really shouldn't say how it's changed, because I'm not involved in the art world and I don't have an intimate knowledge or even well-placed opinions about what's changed in art in galleries in Chelsea, in New York. But what I have observed leads me to think that while at the turn of the millennium there was a sense that much of the power of art, visual art, was in its visceral strength, that it elicited a feeling in the body as well as the mind. And what I see happening more and more from my very ignorant point of view is that art has become more conceptual and more intellectual. I often walk into a gallery, look at a thing, and then have to read for half an hour what it means. I'm not saying that's less valuable than art from 20 years ago, but it's certainly different. And I wanted to capture in my year of rest and relaxation a time where art really was extremely visceral, immediate, very visual, to the point of disgusting absurdity. That I thought was hilarious.
And we do get plenty of that in this book, in some of the artists. Mm-hmm. The last time we spoke, we talked about some other writers that might be an influence on your writing in general. And I wanted to talk about what other writers might have been an influence on this book in particular.
You know, people ask me this a lot, and my answer is consistently one note, and it's that I didn't read very much at all when I was writing this book. I read a little bit for research, mostly about the art world, but if there was a novel that influenced me, I would have to say that it was American Psycho by Bret Easton Ellis. I wasn't reading the book at the time, but I had read it. And I kept it as a reference point for myself to help me understand the distance between myself as the author and my character as my narrator, so that I could manipulate my narrator without losing her sense of authenticity in the voice.
Yeah. It's funny because I immediately thought of American Psycho, but didn't really want to say that because it seemed too obvious. But yeah, you can definitely see its influence in this book, I think.
I mean, it's really obvious why I would think of it, too. I mean, it's a, you know, American Psycho is in a different, takes place in a different period in New York, but it is, you know, a sort of a satire of the city and the culture, especially to do with the moneyed parts of culture. I mean, when I pictured Trevor, I would almost picture Patrick Bateman, even though Trevor really isn't a murdering psychopath at all. But he might dress like like that. Yeah, I mean, I love how far he pushed that character. That was really inspiring. I think Alice is a writer that I would never compare my work to, but who I think is so peculiarly genius that reading, like I just reread Less Than Zero, and I just find him so different from anyone else and really astonishing. I really, really admire his work.
And then just one thing from me, and then I'll get you to read some if you would.
Oh,
what are you going to be working on next?
I'm working on a new novel at very early stages, so not much to report yet. I'm really just doing research, but it's narrated by a ghost. So I'm not setting out to write comedy. It's a little bit more of a serious and historical novel. It takes place the turn of the last century, about a young Chinese woman who immigrates to California during the Chinese Exclusion Act, so she has to do so in drag and then live as a man with much difficulty in San Francisco, in a fictionalized San Francisco in the early 1900s. So it's sort of a saga, and I haven't written it yet.
Well, it sounds amazing.
Thanks.
Can I get you to read?
Riva had an interesting method of mixing her drinks. After each sip of Diet Mountain Dew, she'd pour a little Jose Cuervo into the can to take up the space her sip had displaced, so that by the time she finished, she was drinking straight tequila. It was fascinating to me. I caught myself imagining the ratio of Diet Mountain Dew to Jose Cuervo in that can, what the formula would be to measure it sip by sip. I'd studied Zeno's paradox in high school algebra, but never fully understood it. Infinite divisibility, theory of having, whatever it was. That philosophical quandary was exactly the kind of thing Trevor would have loved to explain to me. He'd sit across from me at dinner, slurping his ice water, muttering fluently about fractions of cents and the fluctuating price of oil, for example, all while his eyes scanned the room behind me as though to affirm to me that I was stupid, I was boring. Someone far better might be getting up from a table to go powder her nose. The thought stung. I still couldn't accept that Trevor was a loser and a moron. I didn't want to believe that I could have degraded myself for someone who didn't deserve it. I was still stuck on that bit of vanity, but I was determined to sleep it away.
So I've been talking to Atessa Moshfegh. We've been talking about her latest novel, My Year of Rest and Relaxation, which is out now from Jonathan Cape. Atessa, thank you so much for sharing it with me.
Thank you.
This episode of Little Atoms was produced and presented by me, Neil Denny, and was first broadcast on Resonance 104.4 FM. Little Atoms is supported by 89UP, and the podcast is hosted by Acast. Find us on iTunes, and if you like the show, please do leave us a review. You can find old interviews, new journalism and more on our website, littleatoms.com. Thanks for listening.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. quince.com/style.
Hey, everyone. Craig Robinson here. I want you to check out the Ways to Win podcast, brought to you by Ford and the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. On Ways to Win, Coach Cal and I will discuss leadership lessons we've learned. We know all about the days spent perfecting your craft outside of the limelight and have knowledge to share about how strength, inspiration, encouragement, and adaptability are the key ingredients to drive toward your dreams. And those same ingredients can be found in the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. So check out my podcast, Ways to Win, and also check out the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. Learn more at Ford.com. Built Ford tough, built Ford proud.